walk across the courtyard towards the library. I can hear the insects buzz and the leaves beneath my feet.
Hello, Kodiak, and welcome to another episode of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. I'm Athenia, host of your show, and I'm excited to tell you that once again we have a fantastic show for you. Heather Lendy is here today on the Beyond the Covers segment, where Tayton talks to her about her upcoming event on February 26th at the Kodiak College. This is a public and free event. She'll do a reading of her book from 2015 called Find the Good, Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer, and also have a small question and answer session. She also discusses some advice she has for young writers. After that, I did an interview with Celia Whitehead about her story build and tell workshops that she's been doing at the Kodiak Public Library. She came by to tell me about stories around the world and share some clips that the kids were kind enough to record for her at the workshop. We are really excited about this story build and tell workshop. It is culminating this month at February 20th with a story slam for teens at the Teen Center. So tune in to hear more about that from Celia. We also have Bob Ross joining us today for another book review featuring a book from the Alaskana Room at the Kodiak Public Library. Today, he's reviewing The Notorious Failure by Smokey Stover. He also talks a little bit about Lola Harvey's book, Derivnia's Daughter, Saga of an Alaska Village, and ties it in with some Mirror articles, along with, of course, the resource of Smokey Stover's book, to give us the tale of the Terror of a Fog Neck, a real-life story of a man who lived in a fog neck that was potentially responsible for the deaths of many people in the town and ultimately came to an untimely death himself. It's a great story, so stick around for that. Without further ado, here's Tayton on Beyond the Cover of Dog-Eared Reads.
So I'll watch you through the bouquet, imagining a scene.
This is Tayton, and welcome to Beyond the Cover, our segment in Dog-Eared Reads, where we'll talk with authors, musicians, and other performers coming to or living in Kodiak. On today's segment of Beyond the Cover, we'll chat with Haines, Alaska author Heather Lendy. Lendy lives in Haines with her husband, who runs a lumberyard, and where they raised five children. She is the obituary writer for the local Chilkat Valley News, has a column in the Alaska Dispatch News, and has contributed essays to a long list of magazines and newspapers over the years, including the Christian Science Monitor, the New York Times, and Women's Day. Her first book, If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name, News from Small Town Alaska, was a 2005 New York Times bestseller. Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs, A True Story of Bad Breaks and Small Miracles, was published in 2011. And her latest book, published just last year, is titled Find the Good, Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer. The New York Times Book Review says that in Find the Good, Lendy, quote, teases wisdom from the lives her obits celebrate as well as from her own experiences as a mother and grandmother. Each conveys the unsentimental conviction that the good in our lives shouldn't be overshadowed by their inevitable end. Heather Lendy will be in Kodiak for a reading and a question and answer session at Kodiak College on Friday, February 26. The event starts at 7 p.m. and is free and open to the public. Lendy will be available for book signings afterwards. Visit the Kodiak College website for additional information. Heather Lendy, welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's nice to be on the radio in Kodiak.
To start us off, could you tell us where you're originally from and about the trajectory that ultimately took you to Haines, Alaska?
I grew up in New York on Long Island in the suburbs of the city, and my mom was a high school principal in a Quaker school, and my dad was in the jewelry business, and I had two younger sisters. And I went to Middlebury College in Vermont, and I met my husband there, and we got married after I graduated. So I was 22, I guess. And he, in the meantime, had gotten a master's degree in forestry and wanted to go where big trees were. So we bought a pickup truck and drove to Alaska. And we ended up, we actually took the Marine Highway up and came through Haines about the time the sawmill, the Schnabel Lumber Company, had just closed. And we thought it was just beautiful, but we kept going to Anchorage to look for work. And we were in the Anchorage, Mat-Su area for about a year and a half before he got a job at the second incarnation of the sawmill in Haines, and we came down here. And we've pretty much been here ever since. Again, another sawmill went broke, and we ended up owning a small lumber yard and a hardware store, Ace Hardware Store, that we're celebrating 30 years of ownership this year. He's owned it since 1986.
Awesome. Congratulations.
So that's kind of the Alaskan trajectory. And I'm, what am I, I'm 56, 57 right now. So I've lived in Alaska longer than the East Coast of my childhood. And we've also raised 5 children here. And now I have 5 grandchildren that are all in Haines or Juneau.
Well, clearly Alaska and Haines stuck for you then. What appeals to you about small-town Alaska life?
Oh, you know, it's my home, I guess. I maybe because I grew up in a suburb where, you know, we didn't even really know our next-door neighbors very well, or the communities weren't the same. I love small-town life, and I like knowing kind of everybody. I like it that my children knew their school teachers before the first day of school. I enjoy that part of it very much. And, you know, I don't know what makes a place a home or why, but there's just some of us, I guess, are lucky to have been born in the place that we feel most at home with, and others are lucky to find that kind of place. But my favorite place in the whole world is pretty much my own backyard, and it has been for 30 years. I have an opportunity now to travel a little more than I used to, and I still feel that way, you know? So it's just, I guess it's luck and it finding the right spot. I think a lot of Alaskans have similar feelings. I just had a visit from Ernestine Hayes, whose book Blonde Indian is being read around Alaska, and I think probably in Kodiak you're reading it too. And she said something in that as a Tlingit woman, she said, we don't own the land owns us. And at her talk here, somebody asked her, so, Ernestine, if you're not an Alaskan native, is it possible for the land to own you too? And she said, sure. If you feel, you know, we all have been in those situations where we feel that this place is ours, well, then it's so. And I feel that way about Haines.
You know, I think a lot of people in Kodiak here could relate to that as well.
Yeah, and you know, and it's interesting. I'd say a lot of people on Long Island wouldn't say that where I grew up. You know, people who live in those kind of places don't necessarily have that attachment. And I suppose much of it has to do with the landscape and the land itself, and the mountains and the rivers and the fish and the. You know, it's invigorating in a way and inspiring just to be living here.
Right, right. Just thinking about that trajectory as well. You're a writer, right? And that's why we have you on the library program here. What did you want to be when you grew up? Did you want to be a writer? Did you find your way to it?
You know, I don't even remember. I didn't say, oh, when I grew up, I'm going to be a writer. No, I think at one point I wanted to be an actress. I was going to be a teacher. My family, I have a lot of teachers in my family. My daughters are teachers. I don't know if I'd even thought about it so much. When I went to college, I studied history, and I've always been a storyteller. And when I first came to Alaska, of course, it was the time when we wrote a lot of letters. And I remember writing letters and people saying, you should publish these. These are really good. You know, the stories you're telling about trying to get a job or having your children in, you know, a rural clinic or whatever, they're great stories. And pretty soon I did start writing them down. At first, I actually, when I began my, well, I guess you'd call it writing career now, I was the local radio station and I did commentary, because I was more comfortable speaking than writing. And then I translated my talking into print, and it's, I suppose, why people find my writing is very conversational, because it's on purpose. It's sort of talked first and written second.
Right. So you've done all kinds of writing, right? You mentioned the radio program, but you've written for, and tell me if this is correct, the Alaska Dispatch News, the Christian Science Monitor, Women's Day, a whole bunch of newspapers and magazines. And then you're also the obituary writer for your local Chilkat Valley News. Did you start out writing obituaries?
First, I was at the newspaper, and I was writing Duly Noted, which is our boldface social column. Chilkat Valley News is a weekly paper, right? And we have a little column like, you know, Heather Lindy went to Kodiak, and while she was there, she saw Sarah Lowen, the sister of Reuben Lowen in Haines, you know, something like that. And it would be, those names would all be in boldface. That's the Duly Noted column. And I was writing that for the local paper because an elderly woman who had been a former English teacher was doing it. And when her husband died, I asked Doris Ward if there was anything I could do for her. And she handed me her little notebook and pen and said, yeah, you can write Duly Noted. I don't want to do it anymore. So that'll teach you to ask someone who's grieving what kind of help they need.
Right.
And you have to say yes. So I ended up with Duly Noted. And then what happened was an elderly woman was dying who was the mother of a friend of mine, a good friend of mine. And the newspaper had hired a new reporter, kind of an investigative type, you know, from down south. And the woman, Nedra Waterman, she didn't like him. She felt he was too negative and was asking too many questions and putting people on the spot. And in Haines, obituaries are news. And the reporter typically would write the story, which is sort of a hybrid of profile and your standard obituary. And Nedra requested that the new reporter didn't write hers. And since the newspaper consisted of an editor and a reporter, the editor said, Heather, why don't you do it? Because you write about live people, you can write about dead people. And so I did. And that was 1996. And pretty much since then, I've been doing all of them. Sometimes if there's a few in a week or if I'm away, the editor will do it or another reporter will. But basically, it's been kind of my beat.
Mm-hmm. So how do you write a good obituary? Seems like that would be a difficult thing to do.
No, I mean, it's not all that hard. There's sort of a format with us, with a typical sort of a newspaper thing. You know, you start with the most important part first. Most people in town know the person has died, especially if it's a weekly paper, right? And so you say when the service is going to be. You know, so-and-so passed away, and there's going to be a service on this date, a time, and then you write what they died of and where. And then sort of a summary of what they did in the community. You know, the former teacher was active in Boy Scouts and City League basketball. And then you go with the details, just like with any good writing. Have a friend describe their jump shot or somebody else talk about a particular way they ran their classroom, maybe some rule or something that gives an indication into what kind of person they were. I always avoid things like never met someone who didn't like or, you know, would give you the shirt off his back or loved by all or, you know, will be greatly missed. You try to have a concrete example of their generosity or their kindness or their quirky sense of humor or their particular way of addressing people at work or whatever it is. You get specific examples from friends and family and quotes and put it together that way. I like to say, I guess, when I'm writing an obituary, when someone says, you know, my mom was just the sweetest lady, and then I'll say, in my mind, I'm saying, prove it. But to them, I'll say, can you give me an example? You know, something, because sweet means there's different sweetnesses and different ways to come up with that. And it might be that they baked cookies for the people at the post office every year at Christmas, or it might mean that they went to the animal shelter and cleaned all the kennels and made sure they always brought the dog a biscuit. Those illustrations would describe a different person than just saying sweet, you know?
Sure. It sounds like, and really, those are all the things you've described, those concrete details and examples. That's what makes good writing anyway.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, ultimately with writing the obituaries, the hardest part is, and I suppose it's true with any writing, is the hardest part is what to put in and what not to put in. You only have limited space. And I suppose that's been the story of my whole life in writing. When you're writing a column, when you're writing a radio piece, when you're writing an obituary, you're limited to the medium that it's going to be in. You know, a column might be 700 words, a radio piece might only be 300, 350. An obituary, it depends on the paper. It's a weekly paper, and my editor will, you know, I'll always ask every time, you know, how long can it be, Tom? And he'll say, Tom Morford edits the paper, and he'll say, oh, we're short on ads this week, make it long. Or we got a lot of ads, if you keep it tight. And that's, unfortunately, for the people who died that week, that's really what determines the length of it, not their illustrious life.
You're listening to Beyond the Cover and Dog-Eared Reads on KODK 90.7. We're talking today with Haines, Alaska author Heather Lendy, whose most recent book is titled Find the Good, Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer. So your latest book, Find the Good, could you talk a little bit about your writing process for this book and maybe some of the other stories and articles that you've written, especially about people who've passed on and what your process for writing some of those longer materials are?
Well, this book was a little different because it came out of a kind of a challenge to me. I had to write an essay. I was contacted by a journal that wanted me to write wise last words. You know, something that I'd learned writing obituaries, that so that when I died, what would I say on my deathbed, you know? And those kind of things just panic me. It's sort of like if someone asks you what your favorite 10 books are ever, I start to think of, well, the last 10 good ones I read, and then you think, well, you've got to say this one or that one. I end up with way too much. And so I was like, gosh, you know, well, I want to tell my grandchildren to eat their vegetables or get exercise or be nice to people or whatever it is. And I was under pressure to get this done, and there was a deadline. And finally the editor said, Heather, come on, just three words. Come up with three words. And I surprised myself, and I thought, well, three that would cover kind of everything. Find the good. I mean, if you find the good in people and situations, everything else ought to fall into place, that I would hope for my grandchildren and for anybody's children's children, I guess. And so then, with that in mind, once we decided that a kind of first essay was going to be, I worked with the same editor that I worked with on my other two books, and she said, oh, this would be great, Heather, you know. I looked for obituaries that had taught me some things about finding the good through someone's life that may not necessarily have been obvious at first, or just things that were worth passing on that I'd learned about life by writing an obituary of somebody. I'm thinking one of them that I think about is a guy named Art Jess, who was an elder in our community, a Native man, who always spoke very well, was very wise, and quoted poetry and stories, and was sort of a peacemaker and always looked to in a crowd, you know, Art sort of would say something to calm everybody down in Haines, where we sometimes get a little bad. And I learned after he died that Art really couldn't read or write because he had dyslexia so badly, and that he was a mechanic and very good at it, and so always earned a living, but that the reason he was such a good speaker and a listener was because he had had to be, because he couldn't, his wife would read to him and he'd memorize things, and he really listened carefully because he couldn't take notes. And it was something that someone might have called a disability that actually became what I would call his greatest strength. So it was stories like that that, you know, when you hear something like that, you're just like, wow. Nobody knew it until he had died because he was sort of embarrassed by it in life.
Right, right.
So that was really a stunner to me to hear that. And then when you think about it, oh, that's why. That's why he paid such close attention to everything. He had like a photographic memory because he had to.
Yeah, it sounds like through the process then of writing the obituaries and then going back and looking through the stories, that's where you were able to find the good then.
Yeah, and you try to, you know, whenever I write, you know, of course, when you're writing an obituary, people want to remember the good things. They don't want to remember the bad stuff, and it doesn't mean the bad stuff didn't happen, but it means you can highlight that. I talk in the book about another obituary of someone who, an interesting one for me was because I do tend to be a Pollyanna, an unapologetic optimist. But, you know, life can be hard sometimes, and there was one, an old gold miner who had really been hard-drinking, tough husband. There was issues in the, he had been a difficult man, and then he had had this kind of, you know, Paul on the road to Damascus experience where he heard this voice in a snowstorm when he was driving through the pass and told him to change his ways or going to lose everything, and part of that may have just been him thinking about it, and his family had maybe given him an ultimatum, I don't know, but whatever happened is he did, and he quit drinking, and he became a very sweet, kind grandfather. And his family, when he died, they wanted that story to be told. They didn't want him to become the saint in death that he wasn't in life, but they felt that the redemption part of it was important, and they wanted people to know that, but you couldn't tell that part without some of the rougher stuff, and they wanted that in there.
This is kind of related, I guess, in dealing with loss, and I guess so. What many would take as negative experiences, I guess it seems every time we turn on the TV or open a newspaper, there's some kind of bad news, whether it be something about the Syrian refugee crisis, or there's lead poisoning in the Flint water supply, school shootings, or just everyday accidents. Do you have any advice about finding the good in these other kinds of situations?
Well, I mean, I don't so much, but I do look back, and it sounds kind of corny, and I quote it in the book, too, and I think about that, and it isn't corny. I think it's true, and I think it's something to hold on to. It's that line that, you know, Mr. Rogers from the old TV show, Fred Rogers, he was also a Presbyterian pastor, but he said that his mother would tell him, when you see these bad things, to look for the helpers, look for the people helping. And I look at the Syrian refugee crisis, and you see those people on those Greek islands are putting out, they're standing on the shore at night with flashlights, and they're running down and they're helping people with blankets. And now they've been, what, nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, because these are just people like you and me and Haines and Kodiak, and there's people washing up on the beach. And even in the midst of all the politics of it, you can argue left, right, center about the greater issues of migration. These are still people in rafts landing on a beach in towns like ours, and of course the people there are helping them. That's what we do, no matter what's on the news. That makes me feel better, I guess. And then even in the terrible things like the shootings or school shootings, or you read about that, there's still the EMTs are running in and helping. Teachers are pushing people out of the way. I mean, I still think there's more good than bad. And I think, essentially, people are good.
We often forget about the everyday heroes, then.
Well, yeah. Look in Kodiak, the people on the ambulance crew, you know, every single day they do something. Or you don't even have to have something as noble as a calling like that or such skill. I mean, in Haynes, we get the mail, you know, at the post office. Everybody has to go there to get the mail. And just having Greg or Steve say hi when they give you your mail, that can change the mood in like 2 seconds. They can make a bad day become a good day just by that little interaction. And so I guess I go for the small things that can make a bigger difference in the long run.
Right, right. Well, we'll be excited to have you here in Kodiak to share from some of your work later this month. And we've been talking about Find the Good, but you've written a couple of other nonfiction books, If You Lived Here, I'd Know Your Name, and Take Good Care of the Garden and the Dogs. You've written obituaries, news columns, all kinds of articles. You graduated from the creative writing program at UAA, if I understand correctly. For other aspiring writers out there, we have quite a few here in Kodiak and actually a lot of published authors as well. But for those who are aspiring writers out there, what other kinds of advice might you have?
I think that writing, it's less talent than it is persistence and hard work. And, you know, that's something to remember, that you don't always need inspiration. You just have to sit down and do it every day and as often as you can. If you want to be a writer, then you got to write and practice it. For me, I'm not so good at just holding things to myself. I send them out there. And whether that means writing a piece and sending it to your local newspaper, sending it to a newsletter for an organization, I write for other people to read, not just for myself to understand things. Of course, I do understand things as I write it down, but, you know, find an outlet for it. You know, blogging nowadays, people can do that, and that's a whole other form. So I think it helps to give yourself deadlines and to try to publish things and get them out there, even if you're maybe giving them away sometimes. That's good practice. The other advice I would give any beginning writer, and this is sometimes people have a hard time with this, but I would listen to your editors. They want to make your writing better. And sometimes there's a tendency to say, no, this is how it is, and I've worked so hard, and it's perfect this way. Writing is often fairly collaborative. And if you want people to read what you're writing, you know, you want them to understand it. And if someone else is reading it and they don't get it, maybe listen to them and figure out how you can rewrite it so that what you really mean to say is what you actually have said. So I say pay attention to editors and try to just give yourself some deadlines and get things out there, and don't worry about the great big picture at the moment if you're just kind of getting your toes wet with these things.
Sounds like sound advice. Persistence and feedback, and go for it.
Yeah, and, you know, you have opportunities at public radio. You might with the local paper. You know, there's just places where you may find. I wrote Duly Noted, I mean, for a long time, just practicing writing those sentences. And how many different ways can you write about a wedding in a paragraph? That helps you figure out how language works or how not to be repetitive. Writing obituaries, how do you do that? You don't just get to pick your subject. There's all kinds of practice that you can do.
Well, we do have just time for one more question. What's next for Heather Lendy? Another book, a novel based on a mysterious death, perhaps?
I wrote for my MFA in creative writing. I went to UAA, all those initials, when I was in between. It was actually right when Garden and the Dogs was being published. I studied fiction, and I wrote a novel that I've been rewriting now for since like 5 years, and another book was in between, another nonfiction book, and I'm trying to got about 2 more weeks of some revisions, and then I'm going to send that out in the world and see, and hopefully that'll get published. And it's called A Hole in the Middle of a Pretty Good Heart, and it's about a fisherman and a school teacher and their life together in a small town that's a lot like Haynes that I call Port Chilcoot. And yeah, there's a couple of mysterious deaths in it too. It's not really a mystery, but that's the one I'd like to get going next. And then I don't know, there's always something. Right today I've got to write a column for the Dispatch, and do at the end of the day. And I started writing it about choir practice, but I think I'm going to change it to something else. But I'll know by today at 5 o'clock when I hit the send button.
Do you often find yourself switching gears then?
Yes, yeah, I do. People say, oh, do you know exactly what you're going to write about? And I sit down and I'll write it, and then I'll say to myself, oh, come on, Heather, you're in the newspaper. Say something important. And for me, it's usually the thing that has just happened. And since Ernestine Hayes was here, the author I talked about at the beginning of Blonde Indian, and I had such interesting conversations with her. And then, of course, we were stuck all day yesterday because she was trying to fly out. We had a snowstorm. And so all of these things contributed to something that's rolling around in my head about a column and her book, which I think is very important, and then all Alaska's reading it. So that may be a better story to write at this moment than what happened in choir practice last week.
Well, Heather Lindy, thanks so much for talking with us today. We really appreciate it, and we'll look forward to welcoming you here in Kodiak later this month.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it. I've never been to Kodiak, and I just want to see it.
There'll be hopefully opportunities for that. We'll see how much rain we get.
Well, if it's like Haynes, you can come here for a weekend and miss Haynes completely. Maybe the clouds will lift for a minute and I'll get to see something. It's just going to be an adventure getting there.
Well, thank you so much, Heather.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Heather Lindy will be in Kodiak for a reading and question and answer session at Kodiak College on Friday, February 26th. The event starts at 7 p.m. and is free and open to the public. Lindy will be available for book signings afterwards. Visit the Kodiak College website for additional information. This is Tayton. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Cover and Dog-Eared Reads. Until next time, happy reading.
It's already February. Valentine's will be here in no time. Hey, Lisa, how was your weekend?
Really nice.
And how was yours? Mine was okay, but it sounds like yours was better. What did you do?
This weekend, well, remember that thing I was telling you about that I do with my sweetie?
Oh, yeah.
Downfield, though, the goose seemed to have recovered its wits. It stood upright, taking stock, its head so high and perky I feared it might take off and fly after all. When it saw Sweet coming, it turned and sprinted away.
I'm telling you, that goose could run. Seeing this, Sweet lowered her head and went full steam. Mud and chaff were raining off her boot soles.
Dad started laughing, whipping off his cap and whacking it on his leg, while the goose stretched out its neck and bolted across the barley.
Reaching the end of the field, it encountered a barbed wire fence. It stopped and turned as Sweet closed in.
Did you ever see an angry goose up close? It's a different bird from those you've watched flying south or waddling in city parks.
An adult goose in a wrathful mood can stand up and look a third grader right in the eye.
And that's what this fellow did to Sweet. She got within a yard and stopped cold.
Wow. Now I am jealous.
Reading out loud to your sweetie. Try it. You'll like it. A happy Valentine's message brought to you from your Kodiak Public Library.
Thank you to the Kodiak Public Library for that fun little Valentine's Day message. And in case you were wondering, that excerpt that they were reading aloud to each other was from Peace Like a River by Leif Anger. And actually, on Goodreads, this was reviewed as being a book that begs to be read aloud. So definitely an idea if you want something romantic to do with your sweetie next week. If you're just tuning in, this is Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA, and I'm your host, Athenia. Now, the Kodiak Public Library Association is always up to fun things, and we want you, the people of Kodiak, to be involved as well. So visit us on our website, www.kodiakpubliclibraryassociation.org, and see what we're up to. Find us on Facebook, Twitter. You can email us at kpla.alaska@gmail.com. We want you to check us out, get involved, volunteer with us, or give us your ideas on how we can make the Kodiak Public Library Association even better. Our annual meeting is coming up March 21st, and we'd love to see you there. And to give you a little idea of what we've been up to, up next, I have Celia Whitehead. She has been doing the Story Build and Tell program that the Kodiak Public Library Association has sponsored at the library. Hi, Celia.
Hi, Athenia. Thank you for having me back.
It's always great to have you here. So you were talking to us last month a little bit about your Story Build and Tell projects. What were you up to this month?
Well, January was stories from around the world. And so on January 16th, I had a great, it was the biggest group so far. We had a wonderful time. I started by telling a story that comes from Africa about how the leopard got its spots and how the turtle got its shell. And after I told the story, we told the story as a circle where each participant got to say one sentence of what happened in the story. And so in that way, you really get to see what people are hearing and what they're listening to and what interests them about the story. And then we acted it out. They all got to be different animals from the jungle. So after telling all of these stories, I asked the participants to do a little bit of creative thinking themselves and come up with a how things came to be the way they are on Kodiak. And we used examples of, you know, it could be a different geographical feature like a mountain or a lake or the tides. It could be weather or animals, particularly animals, how animals came to be the way they are, and using your imagination to think about what it might have been before, sometime in the past, when we don't know, when things were different. And so we got a lot of great stories out of that.
So did the kids work independently, or did you have them in small groups coming up with their own individual stories?
So the kids broke up mostly into pairs or groups of three to come up with a story. But they had so many ideas that often there was one group in particular that ended up, they each just had to do their own story because none of them wanted to give up their idea.
Oh, that's fun. So you must have got a lot of good ones. Let's have an introduction and listen to just a few of them.
Yeah, well, I'll give you the ones that turned out the best on the recording because we were just doing some on-the-scene recording, so you never know how things are going to turn out. But here's one that turned out great. The theme of the story was how the chipmunks got their fur because, you know, way long ago they were just naked.
All right, let's listen to that.
How the chipmunks got their fur. A long time ago, there was a chipmunks tribe. The king said to the tribe, "We need fur. Chipmunka, will you get us fur?" "Yes, I will. I will sneak to the farms in the dead of night and get us fur. Pig fur." So that night, she snuck to the farms and stole pig's fur. She brought the fur to the king. Chipmunka said, "It's a little muddy, but that will help it stick." The end.
Okay, I like that one a lot. So the pigs are furry and the chipmunks aren't. And so they steal the furry, muddy fur from the pigs. And the mud helps it stick onto the chipmunks. Yeah, that's classic.
Those are just priceless details that you'd never think of ahead of time, but creating stories from scratch can come up with so much great, fertile creativity.
And did you find that it was a challenge to get them to kind of focus on the details, or was it real easy to keep them on task to the project?
Oh, they were super focused. I think they all would have loved to have a little bit more time. So even in a 3-hour workshop, we ended up kind of short on time at the end.
Oh, that's how you know they're having fun. All right, so what's the next one on your list you want to introduce?
Next, I would like to share with you another original Kodiak story of how a star turned into a sea star.
One star turned into a sea star. Once upon a time, there was a clear ocean, so clear that one night the stars came right down to get a closer look, but they all fell in. They were so hot that they burned a dolphin's back. Then they dried out, and that is the story of how sea stars became sea stars, because they dried out.
It's a very poetic image, that perfectly clear ocean, and the stars are so, curious. They go down and down until they fall in. Yes, and then they burned the dolphin's back. So I think that the dolphin may have ended up in that story because I was encouraging the participants to add a few more characters into their stories to make a slightly more complex storyline as they were coming up with where things started and where they ended and how they got there, how they came to be the way they are.
Right, that makes sense. In a lot of the traditional fables, you have animals interacting with other animals, and that's how they gain their peculiarities. So that was the dolphin's role, huh, to help the stars.
There was another great story that unfortunately didn't record so well about how foxes got so tricky. And it was all about how way back in the day, none of the animals ever played tricks on each other. It was like a law of nature that they didn't play tricks on each other. But the animals decided to play one trick, and they would play it on the fox. And after Fox had that trick played on him, he said, "Never again. I am going to be the trickster from now on."
No, that's smart. And it's true. The fox is pretty tricky in folklore in general.
It just depends on what part of the country you're in. The right. Fox, the coyote, the raven.
Yeah.
The spider.
Right? The spider, yeah. Good. So what else have you got?
Up next for this show, I would like to share with you why seagulls are so noisy.
The title of my story is Why Seagulls Are So Noisy. Once upon a time, seagulls were not noisy. They couldn't say anything at all. All the animals in the sea knew it, except for the narwhal, because the narwhal had just been made. So the narwhal came up to the seagull and asked the seagull, "What are you?" And the seagull couldn't talk. The narwhal asked again, "What are you?" A little more patient this time. The seagull still couldn't say a word. And the narwhal kept asking and asking the seagull until it got so fed up with the seagull, it poked the seagull.
With its horn.
And then the seagull yowled and yowled and yowled and yelled, "I'm a seagull, I'm a seagull, I'm a seagull, I'm a seagull." And then it couldn't stop talking. And that's why seagulls are so noisy.
I like that the narwhal poked the seagull. And I like how it sounded like you had a few seagulls in your class. Some chatter in the background there.
It was definitely a lively group. Well, a lot of old fables and tales, I mean, there are such simple stories. And they're often written that way, very simply. And so they don't really have that spark that brings out all of the life that's in them until you take them off the page and tell them out loud. That was another one of the activities we did, actually. I told them a story, and then I read them a version off the page and asked what they liked better. And it was definitely the live telling.
Oh, yeah.
And showing kids that their ideas are just as valuable and creative and worth putting into a book as any other idea that any author put into a book in any time, and empowering kids to hopefully become storytellers and writers and creators of whatever they choose to create in their lives.
Yeah, that's a great motivation for what sounds like a fun class. All right, well, I don't want to keep you here for too long, but I want to hear, what are some of those other stories?
Well, each idea was so original and fun. So we heard about how chipmunks got their fur. Another story I got to learn about was why foxes are so tricky. How the otter got his name. He was very odd. You can take it from there. Why Arctic foxes turned white. Why moose got their big antlers. And there is a hidden sub-story in there of where farts came from. So there, you can fit many, many lessons in one story. And how the ermine's tails got black, the tips of their tails.
Oh, nice. So they were really using some Alaskan animals, the kind of things that we see around here. Good. Well, I really appreciate you coming down to continue letting us know how much fun these kids are having in your story build and tell workshops. And if I understand correctly, you have one more workshop coming up next month, and it's kind of a galley tables theme.
Yeah, and by galley tables theme, it's about telling true stories from your own life. So a little bit of a different take from these kind of creative pursuits like fracturing fairy tales or looking at how things came to be the way they are in these creation tales. These are the stories that matter to you from your life. And this one is going to be at the Teen Center. So if you're interested in participating, if you know any youngins who might be interested in participating. It is happening on February 20th, Saturday, from 1 to 4 at the Teen Center. And it will be a bunch of workshop time and then hopefully an opportunity to share stories with a mic and really get a feel of what it's like to bring yourself out through a performance.
Great. And we're definitely hoping to have some of those performances airing here on Dog-Eared Reads next month. If you're interested, stay tuned again next month on Dog-Eared Reads, where Celia Whitehead will come back and share more story build and tell with us.
And just to put out a little plug about the momentum of all of this storytelling, I'm hoping that this next story build and tell will be part of getting a bunch of students interested in signing up to tell at a really big event that is going to be happening at the end of April. This is going to be called True Voice, a Youth Story Slam. We'll be having some really big prizes for everyone who participates, and especially for the top three tellers. But we're hoping to see a lot more of Kodiak's youth sharing their stories and the formative stories of their lives and getting those voices heard and out to the community.
Right, and that's actually not going through the Kodiak Public Library or even the Kodiak Public Library Association. Who's helping put that on?
The big event in April, the Youth Story Slam, is a collaboration between Galley Tables, Shunik Tribe Youth Advocacy, and KIBSD Youth Advocacy.
That's a great collaboration with a wonderful idea. And in April, that night itself will be open to the public so we can go and see the kids.
It will be free and open to the public.
Yeah, so those are definitely some dates to remember.
Yeah, so February 20th from 1 to 4 at the Teen Center. A little mini story slam and workshop on telling your own stories.
And then the big lead up to
April 29th at 7 p.m. at the Gerald C. Wilson Auditorium. We're putting together student clubs to be tabling and a photo booth and snow cone machine. And the Alutiiq dancers will be performing at intermission, and it's going to be a huge, fun event.
Thank you, Celia, for visiting with us, and I look forward to seeing you again next month.
All right. Thank you so much, Athenia. And many thanks to the participants who have come out for the Story Build and Tell series through the Kodiak Public Library.
It's true. We always really appreciate it when you come out and participate in the programs going on at the library. Everyone's happy to see you. We have so much more fun when people show up.
Ain't it the truth?
All right, another quick thank you to Celia for joining us here on Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA. People of Kodiak, there are a lot of storytelling events happening this month. The Kodiak Public Library was selected also to participate in Dark Winter Nights, True Stories from Alaska Statewide Storytelling Events. This is happening Thursday, February 25th, and we are one of five libraries in the state selected to participate in this Online with Libraries OWL-sponsored event. Now let's move on and let me introduce to you Bob Ross, who's here once again to share with us a review of a book from the Alaskana section of the Kodiak Public Library. I have read and enjoyed this book, but had no idea about the reference to the fascinating story of the Terror of a Fog Neck. Let's hear what Bob has to say.
Hello and welcome to another in the series of book reviews from the Alaska Room of your Kodiak Public Library. I'm Bob Ross, and it's my pleasure to share with you this month's selection, The Retired Failure by Paul H. Stover, or Smokey Stover, as he preferred to be known. This book was published in 1976. It is 59 pages, self-published book that is a tongue-in-cheek look at Kodiak's development, happenings, and politics from 1945 to the mid-1970s by one who had lived it and knew. The author's first paragraph sums up his humor for the story told. Quote, "The events of this book take place in the territory and state of Alaska and are based on both fact and fiction. If you do not believe the reality of some of the events, just assume them to be fictitious." Unquote. I first met Smokey through my scouting. He was the Kodiak Boy Scout Troop 524 Scoutmaster and had been so long before I knew him. I knew him as an easygoing, straightforward adult leader. I eventually became his junior assistant scoutmaster when I was in high school. This book was therefore a surprise to find and to read a half century after I had known him. Based on my research and readings of the Kodiak Mirror and other source material covering the 1940 to 1947 time period, and from having lived in Kodiak from 1959 to 1971, this book is Smokey Stover's autobiography with few punches pulled. I found both his lack of dates and lack of names a bit of an inconvenience, but the brief factual information he has given is invaluable to both my curiosity and my research interests. He glosses over his military service, but by the pictures and brief narrative included, he was an Alaska war hero. He was on Attu with the 50th Engineer Regiment combat on 29 May 1943. At 3:30 a.m. on that morning, the Japanese attempted a mass breakout from their mountain stronghold. Most of the American combat strength was in the mountains encircling and containing this Japanese position. 1,000 or more Japanese, their entire effective combat strength, attacked up the valley floor, breaking through Company B, 32nd Infantry Regiment. The engineer force on the hill midway down the valley was all that stood between the Japanese and their apparent goal of overrunning the beachhead and the supply zone. This was to be the single bloodiest engagement of the entire Alaskan campaign. Smokey states, quote, "When the war ended, about 90 years later, old man Stover was shipped back to the good old USA," unquote. I like this book on a multiple level. As stated, it added to my research knowledge once the time period and identification of people being discussed was determined. If you're like my producer and editor, Athenia, you may be too young or too new to Kodiak to have shared a history with Smokey and his contemporaries. For you, then, this book is light, humorous reading of Kodiak in bygone years. If you are one such as Betty Nelson, long lived in the Kodiak area, you will probably recognize readily the individuals and perhaps even the incidents related. We take as an example the person called John on page 8. Smokey writes, quote, "I am sure a very interesting book could easily be written on the judicial past of this village. I had occasion to be appointed to go to a nearby village as a member of the coroner's jury. This was to investigate the cause of death of a person we shall call John. John was the village terror, and although a rather small person, had disposed of a number of village residents, including one of his own sons. Upon arrival at the village, we walked down the main thoroughfare. This village has the longest main street in Alaska, 2 miles long and 2 feet wide, to where John, the village terror, lay stiff as a board on the November crust of snow. Our marshal, who had nothing but trouble from John, rolled him over with his foot and commented, 'John, you old SOB, this is the first time since we met that I've been glad to see you.' We formed a coroner's jury on the spot, consisting of myself and 4 villagers, and concluded that John had met death by accident. It is interesting to know that one member of this jury had nothing to do with the 4 accidents John had run into the night before behind the local dance hall." This paragraph brings closure to a story first read in the August 1, 1942, The Kodiak Mirror, headlined, "Father is Held After Son's Death." The article reads, quote, "The body of John Toshwalk, Jr., about 20, was found floating in Litnik Bay near Afognak on 29 July by J. L. Smith, connected with the Navy, who ordered a guard placed over the father of the boy, John Toshwalk, Sr., and then notified the proper officials of his find. It was estimated the body had been in the water about 22 days, and when the body was discovered, there was a piece of rope around the neck. The jury found the death was caused by a blow to the head, administered by person or persons unknown, and it was conclusively shown that drowning and shooting were not responsible for death. Testimony rendered by the witnesses was such as to warrant the arrest of the father and to hold him for a full and complete investigation. It was brought out in the testimony that the last time young Toshwalk was seen alive was on the afternoon of July 4th, when he attended a party and picnic, at which there was drinking. First knowledge that he was missing came on 7 July, when the father applied for a Navy pass, stating that he wanted to enter the bay to get his dory, which the boy had been using. On return with the dory, the naval men gave it a customary search, and at that time it was testified that he kept repeating, 'I didn't kill him. He drowned.' After the inquest, Here, Deputy U.S. Marshal Paul Herring went to Afognak to investigate and brought the father back with him. A continuance has been asked in this case to procure witnesses, and the hearing has not been set. Last year, the elder Toshwak was held in jail here in connection with the death of Bill Nekrasov, a brother-in-law by former marriage. But lack of corpus delicti, and because of the element of self-defense, entered the case, he was never brought to trial. Funeral services for the deceased were held Monday with burial in the Russian cemetery. He was preceded in death by his mother, unquote. From this Mirror article, one finds John Toshwak Jr. apparently bludgeoned, shot, strangled, and drowned, with Mr. John Toshwak Sr. rambling that he had not killed him. It would appear whoever did kill John Toshwak Jr. with a blow to the head then tried to dispose of the body, shooting through the body to deflate the lungs, tying a rope around the neck to a weight, and dumping him in the bay. Further Mirror articles touched on the trial of John Toshwak Sr. and the many Kodiak people flying to Anchorage to give evidence in his trial. A later article reported his conviction of the murder and sentencing to life imprisonment for the crime. Then in 1943, or 1944 as I recall, a bombshell article telling of his release from prison following the case being overturned by the Alaska Court of Appeals. The ruling stated in part that the case was all circumstantial and had not been proven to have been perpetuated by John Toshwak Sr. The case was not retried, and John Toshwak Sr. again roamed the streets of Afognak. I next heard of John Toshwak Sr. in Lola Harvey's book, Derivnia's Daughter, Saga of an Alaskan Village. The last two pages of Chapter 38, having to do with 1947, contain the following narrative. Quote, "Every day from someone who came into the store, Herman von Scheele got a status report on the construction of the new chapel and living quarters being built in Afognak for their Slavic gospel missionary folks that everyone thought would have left long before. They had persevered, however, and in addition to the much older Russian Orthodox Church, they served the village need for religious tradition and stability. Both churches had begun preparation for their respective holidays. The gospel missionaries would celebrate Christmas on December 25th, and those of the Orthodox faith keeping with the Julian calendar of Christmas on January 7th. Bob's mailboat, the Shuyak, brought a lot of Christmas cheer, more than Herman was sure the people of Afognak needed or could prudently consume. The arrival of the mailboat was always an excuse to make a dance, but the temperament of the jovial village people was such that no reason was needed. Everyone, it seemed, loved to dance. On this occasion, however, the revelry ended in a terrible violence, attempted murder, death, and the quiet, unified suppression of the facts surrounding the incident by those who knew. The morning after the dance was held at the house of John Toshwak, he was found dead, lying in front of his house with blood all over his face. Because of what happened at the dance, his body was not moved for 2 days until the marshal from Kodiak arrived to investigate the circumstances. The marshal was told that the man, who had been drinking heavily, became enraged and began shooting, trying to kill his son, in a bedroom of the house. The man was killed, villagers say, as they tried to disarm him as he was about to shoot again at his son. The man had been convicted of murder of another son 5 years before, but he never served a sentence. Prior to that incident, he was held but never tried for the murder of a brother-in-law. After his investigation, the marshal concluded that the drunken fellow had been beaten to death by two men whose names were not disclosed. The death of the man known as the Terror of Afognak was adjudged to be an accident. Finally, continuing the saga of John Toshwak from an interview with Betty Nelson in October of 2014 at her Port Lyons home, she remembers as a young girl memories of her life in Afognak village. "He was the terror," she says, "akin to how a parent would tell their children to be good or the boogeyman will come out and get you." She said she remembers wanting much to attend the dance that was held the night that John Toshwak died. She was kept home by her parents because, quote, "something was going to happen," unquote. She also mentioned what the Mirror reported at the time, a possible double murder-suicide in the 1946 time period, the deaths of Strickler and the Bowmans at their home site in Terror Bay. I had read this mirror account in my research review of the microfilm archive in the Alaska Room, but I saw no relevance to a larger picture at that time. Betty states that just a few miles from the Strickler Bowman home site, John Toshwalk had a gillnet site. We have deviated a bit from a straight book review by Smokey Stover. The point I attempt to make is that local history is documented and remembered in many ways from many sources. That John Toshwalk was a disturbed and dangerous man, there can be little doubt. That he might have had something to do with the deaths of an additional three individuals living in Terror Bay near his gillnet site makes as much sense as the scenario adopted by the coroner's jury at the time and reported in the Mirror. That the longtime partner, Mr. Strickland, burnt his house, shotgunned both Mr. and Mrs. Bowman, and then shot himself, for reasons unknown. A brief first-hand account of the crime scene's discovery by Eddie Larson and Bill Bowman is contained on page 359 of Derivnia's Daughter. I highly recommend The Retired Failure for humor, for facts with some digging, and for pleasure. It is a quick read and a Kodiak time capsule covering a span of three decades, told just the way Smokey wanted. To quote his surviving wife, Lois Stover, who was not the least bit spared from Smokey's pranks and humorous tales, who I chanced to meet recently in the Walmart parking lot, quote, "There was only one Smokey Stover." I guess that really sums up this book. I'm Bob Ross, proud to have been a Smokey Stover scout. Thank you for joining me this day as we reviewed part of Smokey Stover's book, The Retired Failure, and discussed briefly The Terror of a Fog Neck. I hope you will join me again when we next review yet another selection or two from the wonderful Alaska Room in your Kodiak Public Library. Thank you.
Thanks again, Bob Ross. That was a great review and a fascinating story about the Terror of a Fog Neck. I'm Athenia, host of Dog-Eared Reads, Fetching Books and Tales by the KPLA, and we have time for one more library tip from another KPLA board member, Lori Madsen.
We all love search engines, love to Google things to find out instant information. But the best quality websites are hard to find amidst all the ads and the stuff that comes back that you don't want. Hi, I want to introduce you to SLED, S-L-E-D, the Statewide Library Electronic Doorway. This is an easy-to-use website that connects people to high-quality information, specifically targeted to Alaskan residents. This free service is available statewide, and it was developed by the Alaska State Library and the Rasmussen Library at University of Alaska Fairbanks. It is currently supported with funds from the Alaska State Library. It's been available since the mid-90s. This electronic doorway, or gateway, allows you to access millions of resources from credible databases, outstanding archives, and genealogical records. The URL, or the website address, is sled.alaska.edu. Are you interested in genealogy? Want to learn about your forefathers and mothers? Heritage Quest Online is a database included in SLED, and you can find census records and information dating back to the Civil War. I was able to access the population of Karlik in 1920. It's a handwritten document, as that's how census records were collected back then. It's quite interesting to see whose great aunt and uncle may have lived in Karlik or around the island at that time. Included in SLED also is an entire section on Alaska genealogy called the Alaska Vital Records, 1816 to 1959. This indexes digital images of birth, marriage, death, divorce, and probate records from Alaska during that time period. Portions are online now, and more records will be posted this year as the images become available. SLED also includes Yukon and Canadian genealogy records for your browsing pleasure. If you're interested in Alaska history, the Alaska's Digital Archive section presents a wealth of historical photographs, photo albums, oral history, moving images, maps, documents, and other materials from libraries, museums, and archives throughout our state. Vast collections of photographs are available in the digital archives, too, and everything is searchable by name, by date, and more. SLED offers other resources like homework help and EBSCO databases, very useful when you're doing research and school projects. I'll tell you more about those databases next time on Dog-Eared Reads. In the meantime, check out SLED. The URL is sled alaska.edu or sled.alaska.edu. And one must be an Alaskan resident and live here to get access to these databases. You can call the State Library at 1-800-440-2919 for a password or for assistance with this wonderful resource. Passwords are also available at the Kodiak Public Library. So next time you stop in, be sure and ask for that password and get started using SLED. It's a marvelous resource. It's great for long distance and anytime learning. Well, that's all we have time for today on this month's Tech Tip on Dog-Eared Reads, brought to you by Kodiak Public Library Association in support of Kodiak's Public Library. Thanks again. So long.